We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, folks, welcome back in to our seventh episode of the Queen City Hoops podcast. This is Spencer Percy, managing editor of Queen City Hoops. I'm here with my good friend and co-host Richie Randall. We hope everyone had a great and blessed Merry Christmas there and are ready for 2017, which is closing in fast. Richie, how was Christmas, my friend?
Oh, it was very good. Like I said, it was very busy for me, traveling from house to house. But yeah, very blessed. I'm very thankful for my family. It was a good time.
Good. And same for me. A lot of basketball that day. Hornets have been busy since Christmas. They didn't play on Christmas, played the day after, and then twice since then. So they've been busy, which we'll go over a little bit more about those three games here in a minute. Richie, some folks might have recognized a little bit of a facelift to the website here recently, and maybe some new graphic artwork and logos on Twitter. So talk to us a little bit about something you had done to help Queen City Hoops from the graphic standpoint.
Yeah, I don't have much background in this per se, but I just wanted to give like a facelift to the website, make it look a little bit more clean, minimalistic. That's kind of like the style that I like. So you should see a new banner on our website, some new logos on Twitter, on Instagram, and as well as elsewhere, wherever we have our QCH name. You will definitely see a difference in our logos, and I hope everyone likes it. I like it better than the previous logo. It just looks more clean and simplistic to me. I know it's not what I'm a professional in, but I think it looks pretty good.
You did a nice job. When I first saw those logos, you sent me the banner and then the few logos, and one of those logos is now my Twitter avatar. I mean, they look awesome. And the color combination you used of the teal, the purple, and the white is really, really cool. So if you folks haven't seen that yet, go check that out. Richie did an awesome job giving us a little bit of a facelift. And kind of staying on that topic for a minute, you know, if you've been a listener of the podcast, again, this is our seventh episode, you know, Richie and I think we're getting better every time out, and, you know, we're providing maybe a different way to listen to a Hornets podcast. There are other ones out there, another really, really good Hornets podcast. So we appreciate our listeners. We have what we hope to be a really exciting announcement on the brink here. And I can't go into detail today, but I just kind of wanted to mention it so you folks could be on the lookout for that. Probably will come after the new year, but podcast is moving upward, gaining momentum quickly, and we'll hopefully have some exciting news coming after the new year. All right, Richie, let's jump in here. Again, the Hornets played three games since Christmas. They were at Brooklyn, they were at Orlando, and then last night they hosted Miami. They go 2-1 in those games. So let's start in the Brooklyn game. I actually didn't see this game live. I did go back and watch that kind of the condensed rerun on NBA.com. Kind of wonky shooting night from Brooklyn. I thought they kind of exceeded what they like to chuck threes.
Oh, yeah.
They're not a great three-point shooting team, but they burned us from there that night. What did you see, Richie? I know you watched this game live. What stuck out to you, and what was a heartbreaking buzzer beater loss for the Hornets in Brooklyn?
Yeah, and it was wonky three-point shooting from the Nets. They do attempt a lot of threes. They're a very fast-paced team. They like to get up and down the court. And they attempt a lot of threes, but they don't make a lot of threes. And I've mentioned this before. Hornets typically give up, you know, three-point shooting to teams that don't actually shoot the ball too well from there. They shot 48% from downtown. So that kind of kept them in the game throughout the game. And then they ended it on a three-point buzzer beater from Foy. I thought Batum played well, and his play is picking up in the month of December. He kept us in the game with his shooting, his distributing. You know, he was very aggressive in the first quarter. He had 6 free throw attempts. So that tells me that he's getting a little bit more assertive. And then Clifford has made a change to the rotation. I'm sure a lot of fans have seen it. Lamb no longer just plays in the second and fourth quarter. He actually is the first, you know, first player off the bench. And he had a strong game as well, especially in the first half. Had 11 points in the first half on 67% shooting. So we knew
Is the Lamb thing just kind of a byproduct of the Bellinelli injury? Because you've been tracking this closer than I have. Or is that, has that actually been going on?
I don't think so. I think it happened in the game that Bellinelli got injured, but Lamb was also the first person in that game regardless, because I think Bellinelli didn't get injured till what, the late first, second quarter, maybe? I don't know.
Right. No, I think it was the second, yeah.
So I think Clifford has saying he's trying to tinker with the lineups to see who works well together. And I think he's come out and said that Lamb is now going to be our first player off the bench. So when Bellinelli comes back from injury, it'll be interesting to see kind of him working back, you know, to getting healthy. But I think that Lamb will still be the first one off the bench.
Yeah, it's interesting. And we're going to talk about Jeremy a little bit more later in the show. But yeah, I mean, the Brooklyn game, I mean, I thought the Hornets, you know, they were good offensively, which you expect to be against a poor Brooklyn defensive team. But man, yeah, the Nets shooting the ball, they're 15-31 from behind the arc in the game. Bogdanovich gets going, and he doesn't need space. He doesn't even jump when he shoots. I mean, he's a tall guy. He has zero filter on when he's going to chuck, and they were going in that night. I mean, I think he really gets their offense going. He's just one of those guys that's going to pull the trigger at any moment, and if the shots are going on, he kind of sparks the momentum for that team. So Bogdanovich gets going. He scores 26, 4 of 7 from deep, gets to the foul line 9 times because you got to close out on him, and he does have some ability to beat you off the closeout on the bounce and get to the rim. Sean Kilpatrick, man, that guy can really play. I like his game. Super athletic, very, very quick with the ball. He's 9 of 15, also 4-7 from deep.
He's got a little swagger to him, too, as well.
He does. I mean, he's got a future in the league. Kilpatrick, I think he's from Cincinnati.
That's correct.
Yeah. Was a really good player at Cincinnati. And then Brook Lopez just kind of does what he does, scores 21. They play through him in the fourth, Richie, and the Hornets really didn't have an answer. I mean, Lopez really had it going. A few offensive, just wonky offensive rebounds there for the Nets late in that game, too. 50-50 balls that the Hornets couldn't get to, were beaten to all night. Just some mistakes down the stretch.
And I also wonder if it's the three-point shooting, because, you know, long rebounds on those shots kind of create a little bit more offensive rebounds.
Sure. No, absolutely. Isaiah Whitehead also comes off the bench and gives the Nets a little spark. But, yeah, just one of those games. Didn't fall the Hornets' way in the end. Randy Foy hits the game-winning buzzer-beater three, and it's his only made field goal of the game, which really rips your heart out. And I thought there's not a whole lot Kimba could do there. I mean, when you actually go back and watch the play, Richie, Foy is setting a baseline, almost stagger screen for trying to think who they were trying to run off that screen. And now I can't remember. It might have been Bogdan. I don't remember who it was.
Right.
And so the play wasn't – it didn't look like the way Foy kind of sprinted up to the top of the key to get the ball. He almost hesitated like, oh, we're at 4 seconds, you know, with this sideline out of bounds.
Yeah.
I got to go get the ball. It didn't look like that was part of the play for him to come to the top.
He definitely was an option A.
Right. No, he wasn't option A. I'm not even sure he was option D. I think they were really looking for that corner three on that almost triple stagger screen that he was part of setting. At about 3.5, 4 seconds, you know, you see it go off in his brain. I got to come get the ball. He sprints up to the top. Kim is helping on that stagger action. And so his – you know, him recovering to catch Foy, that's a delay. So Foy puts it on the floor one time. Kimba, I thought he made a pretty good contest, almost from like Foy, you know, the side of his body. Yeah. And Foy shoots it off balance, kind of leaning forward slash sideways, swish. So it's just one of those shots. There's not much you can do about Hornets lose that one. Anything else here, Richie, before we move on?
And I don't know if we want to talk about it now, but just maybe just giving up too many uncontested threes. I think that, you know, if we want to talk about it now, I think that this game was probably the perfect example of that. And I think our defense is just not built to defend the three.
Yeah.
We give up a lot of threes. We try to protect the paint. We overhelp. Opponents attempt a lot of threes on us, and they don't attempt a lot in the paint.
No, yeah, let's talk about it for a minute. I mean, I watched that game, and I thought the Hornets – I mean, first of all, you're right. Like, the Hornets don't – they overhelp. They pack the paint. It's part of their defensive philosophy, and that's not necessarily going to change. How do you close out on shooters and make them uncomfortable, right? So you can close out, get a hand up, but if the guy has his feet set and he leaves his feet, you know, as a shooter, you're taught to, you know, act like there's nobody running at you. As long as you can catch in rhythm and let it go, jump and shoot the shot, right? How do you close out on a shooter and change his footwork, right? Make him uncomfortable about pulling the trigger because of how quickly you're closing out, or because of the space between you as a defender and him as the shooter. I mean, you watch the Nets, and they catch and they shoot, although the action ends with a Hornets player right there with his hands up. The Hornets got to get better, again, to your point, at closing out or being that step closer on the weak side to close out and make that guy put it on the floor. I mean, that is the NBA, right? I mean, there are so many good isolation players in this league, and the ball goes from side to side so quickly, and the ball goes on the floor, and teams get dribble penetration. How can you close out to open shooters and make them put the ball on the floor or do something else with it other than take a rhythm shot? I mean, that literally is the defense in this league. And the Hornets have struggled. I mean, the teams are shooting a high clip against them from behind the arc, and the Nets, I mean, that was a perfect example of that game. So, you know, adjustments-wise, I don't really know. Being a step closer, you know, to the weak side shooter, I guess, is an adjustment. I don't know that corrects everything, though.
I just don't think it's in our philosophy defensively. I just think that we love to help out off the dribble, and we tend to lead, you know, shooters open. And I just think that our philosophy under Clifford is just wall up that paint, make sure they don't get the easy buckets. I know that NBA is kind of transitioning to a three-point game, but we allow 33-point attempts a game. That's second in the league. So I just think it's in our DNA more than anything.
I agree. And, you know, you ideally want to force teams to take mid-range shots, you know, take right. The rim away, which I think the Hornets do a really good job of, and take the three-point line away, which they don't do a great job of. So, you know, if there's a organic step to the next fold of Hornets defense in Clifford's system this season, you know, it's certainly that. So it's something to monitor. And again, that Nets game I thought was a perfect example of where the Hornets struggle this season defensively. It's just closing off 3-point line.
And last point I'll make on this. I mean, we do allow a lot of 3-point attempts a game, but we're actually only, you know, opponents are only shooting 35% against us from three, which is 10th best in the NBA. So there's 20 of the teams that allow better 3-point shooting than us.
Yeah, and how many are teams taking a game? I think you said this.
30.
30, and that ranks what in the league?
Second worst.
So we allow the second most chucks from behind the arc.
Correct, behind New Orleans.
Behind New Orleans, okay. So something to monitor. The Hornets can certainly get better there. The percentage, like you said, Richie, isn't awful.
Right.
But you'd like to chase more teams off the line. I mean, I think that's the larger point here. Anything else before we move on to Orlando?
No, I think we should move on to the win in Orlando.
Okay, which I think, and you pointed this out, and I think you recapped this game, Richie, this is the most complete game for the Hornets all season, right?
I would say so. I mean, from quarter – well, I say quarter one to quarter four. Our starters didn't play in quarter four outside of MKG. So after the third quarter, the game was over. But, I would say this game is probably the most complete game offensively, defensively, that the Hornets have put together so far. I know that Ibaka Had a very strong first half, 9 of 11 shooting. He's a threat from outside as well. So it's very tough to defend a guy like that. And going into this game, that was kind of the key matchup. Marvin Williams on Ibaka. And he lit it up. He lit it up in the first quarter. His role on the Magic, he plays the whole first quarter. So he was tearing it up in the first quarter. But come third quarter, he was I think he was 0 for 4. So he didn't score at all. And just our defense and our unselfish ball movement was very fun to watch in the third quarter. And we, you know, built the lead up to 30, 33 points in that quarter.
Yeah, everybody got into the mix here. I mean, you look at even the bench. Jeremy Lamb gets 14. Sessions scores 13. Frank didn't have a great night, but he efficiency-wise, which he usually doesn't, but he gets 9. I mean, it was an all-around party for the Hornets offense. Kemba and Batum, I mean, they only take 24 combined field goals. They both go 8 for 12 from the floor, score 41 combined. It was just a pure display of efficiency and really, really fun to watch because we haven't really seen it for four quarters all season from Charlotte. The third quarter was the difference. I mean, Charlotte outscores Orlando 35-13 in the third quarter, and when it happened really, really fast. Charlotte starts pouring in threes, getting steals, getting fast break layups. And just watching Frank Vogel on the bench was something to see. Charlotte shot 70% in the third quarter, 14 of 20 from the field.
And I think 8 assists in that quarter too.
8 assists in that quarter, correct. Turned Orlando over 5 times, which led to 7 Charlotte buckets. Yeah, it was a really fun game to watch and a very complete game. So I don't know. Yeah, outside of that, because this game was kind of over, you know, halfway through the third quarter, I did not watch the fourth quarter.
Well, I mean, it was just reserves playing. That's all it was. So, I mean, I think that the final score is a little misleading. I mean, we only, 19-point deficit? I think it did a little bit more justice for Orlando there because their bench players actually, I think, that were just, you know, getting in their minutes. Hezonja was playing. We were almost like in a run the clock out mode.
Right, right. And don't look in this game, Charlotte goes 18 of 19 from the free throw line. And don't look now, but they're starting to see a real uptick from the free throw line in terms of efficiency, and it's something that, Richie, we know they struggle with early in the season.
Correct. Yeah. I don't know about last night's game, but yeah, overall, I mean, we've been increasing our free throw chances and our percentage as well. So that's something that's a staple in our philosophy. We want to get to the line, but if we're not making them, it does us no good. But we have been increasing our percentage from the line.
Sure. Yeah, so I don't know. There's a whole lot to really dive into this game. It was an important win for Charlotte because I'm not sure anyone actually knew what to expect coming off that heartbreaking Brooklyn loss, having to stay on the road, go down to a Magic team that no one could figure out, but they have some good wins this season. So it was a big one. It was a real big performance for the Hornets. God, this Magic team, Richie, there's few teams that just the pieces fit less in the entire league. I look at Chicago.
Right.
Yeah, Portland's not clicking like a lot of people thought they would this year. But man, this Orlando team, some of the lineups they run out there. I mean, were they
like,
not so many bigs on the floor at one time? I mean, they have Aaron Gordon. They're trying to play him as a two in some lineups. I swear he was out there as a two on the floor with like Ibaka and Biombo and Vucevic in some one lineup. And I'm like, what? I mean, I don't know how you run real NBA offense when you're clogging the arc that much,
and they've tried to stagger it because they now have DJ Augustine starting and hopes of kind of spreading it out a little bit and have Peyton come off the bench. So I mean,
and that has helped. I mean, Peyton has been better off the bench. He wasn't against Charlotte the other night, but they just God, it is unbelievable the pieces they have on this team and how poorly they fit. And then you look at Hezonja, who's a lottery pick for them last year. He can't even get on the floor. No. He does late. He does in the fourth quarter, to your point, because it was all reserves. But, man, yeah, this is a team that doesn't fit. Everyone kind of knew this past summer that what are they doing, signing all these bigs, trading away Oladipo for another big, Ibaka. But I think some guys are going to lose their job in Orlando, Richie, so keep an eye on that. I think so. I mean, that GM cannot be safe. This was a poorly constructed roster. All right, anything on this? So we'll move on to Miami?
On to Miami.
So the Hornets recover in Orlando, and then last night they come home to host the Heat, and it was not pretty. I did watch this game from start to finish. It wasn't pretty at all. The Hornets were very poor offensively, but they did what the Hornets do in most games. They take away their opponent's second chances. So last night, Miami, usually a pretty good offensive rebounding team with Hassan Whiteside, only gets 4 offensive rebounds last night. And on top of that, the Hornets only turned the ball over 9 times, and they actually had almost 50% of those turnovers in the fourth quarter when they got a little bit sloppy. So they just gained more possessions than their opponent. So as ugly as it was last night, those two stats I just mentioned were really too much for Miami to overcome. The Hornets earn 11 more possessions throughout the game than Miami, and they win 91-82, even though the Hornets only shoot 38.7%, right. They still get a 9-point win. So, and it was a big one.
Yeah, I mean, this is your classic, typical Hornets game. I guess what I mean by that, like, you know, the opponent typically shoots better. We, you know, grind it out, play good defense. We don't beat ourselves. We don't turn the ball over. We out-rebound the other team. We get to the line and convert better than the other team does. But this is just your typical classic Hornets game. It wasn't pretty, very sluggish, you know, out of sync at times. But the third quarter, once again, like the Orlando game, was very big. We had an 11-0 run. A lot of highlights in that quarter between the back-to-back dunks with Zeller and Marvin. And then also, you know, Kemba's threes as well. So very, very sluggish game. But this is a typical game for us, and these are the games that we win.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I mean, this was Clifford Ball in his purest form when the offense struggles. Yeah, I mean, I thought Kemba really floated the offense when they needed it, especially in the fourth quarter with that big three to extend the lead to 7. But Miami recognized early on in this game that, well, I think that this was the game plan. You know, we get Charlotte on the heels of a back-to-back. We're going to pack it in, and we're going to make these guys prove it from behind the arc. And Charlotte hasn't been an excellent outside shooting team this season. And that's what Miami did early. As Charlotte comes out and misses, I think, what, said they started 2 of 14, I think, from behind the arc or something like that. So Miami had their game plan. They packed it in. There were very few driving lanes.
Yeah, especially early on. Like, I feel like we were just taking a lot of outside shots early on just because of, you know, the presence of Whiteside in there.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, on the pick and roll, I thought Miami, they did a really good job on a lethal Hornets pick and roll. I mean, they were tagging Zeller on the weak side every single time. So there was really nothing at the rim out of that action. So the ball had to move from side to side. So some driving lanes opened up. I think really that's what led to that monster dunk from Marvin. The ball just starting to pop side to side really without the pick and roll action. And then Zeller also gets that big dunk. I think those came in the third quarter.
Back-to-back possessions, I believe.
Yeah, so the Hornets just did enough in this game. Let's see, looking at the box score here, anything else that really sticks out? Lamb was literally the only bright spot.
On the bench, yeah.
On the bench. The bench was awful. They actually started last night 0 of 12 from the floor. And that's really when Miami started to – they got the lead at that point. I think extended the lead maybe all the way to 6. So Lamb's the only bright spot off the bench. And I thought last night was really the – that was the showcase game for how badly we need Bellinelli back.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we definitely miss him. And I'm not sure when he's going to come back. I'm not sure about any updates. But if I had to bet, it'd probably be Monday of next week or Wednesday against Oklahoma City. I don't see him playing Saturday, which is tomorrow as we're recording this against – Cleveland.
Yeah, I would probably be surprised. There is no update, official update from the team, but he did tweet a picture actually it was after the Orlando game, I think. It was either after the Orlando game or last night. Tweeted a picture of his sprained ankle in ice and said, great win tonight, back soon. So that's what we got. He's going to be
soon.
Back. straight from the horse's mouth. He's back soon. So, but his ankle still was on ice. So there's obviously some swelling that he's still dealing with there. The only other thing that I thought was really interesting, not surprising but interesting, was Hassan Whiteside.
I knew you were going there.
Yeah, I forgot he was on the floor.
Right.
For a lot of that game, I wouldn't touch that guy at the 10-foot pole in free agency.
And I agree to an extent, but I wonder how much of the situation plays into it too. I mean, you shouldn't have to be on a winning team to have interest in what you're doing. But you know, with the way the Heat are playing, you know, well below 500, it probably doesn't help that guy, because that guy's personality, he just is a, you know, a pouter. He doesn't have the best attitude, you know, almost in a Cousins in a way, that he just, if things aren't going right, he's not going to be interested. And he has all the talent in the world, but I wonder if a change of role or situation, a team, could up his play and his interest level, but it shouldn't have to. It shouldn't have to, you know.
No, it shouldn't. I mean, I get your Cousins comparison. I think he's not as emotionally driven as Cousins. I never think that Cousins is necessarily disinterested. I just think he's too emotional. He can't get out of his own way. But, I don't know. Whiteside just last night, it's like he just didn't want to be there. He's like anywhere else in the world right now, just not on this basketball floor.
Yeah, I was expecting maybe a little bit of a scuffle with Zeller, but he probably was uninterested in that too.
Yeah, it was weird. So, and when he's not engaged, the Heat have very little chance to win any game against any team in this league. So it was somewhat surprising on that note that they were even in this game. Gordon Dragic was awful last night too. He's 2 of 11, only scores 5 points. Really, the guys that kept Miami in that game were Josh Richardson, Tyler Johnson, who I really, really like as a player. The Heat did a nice job of retaining him.
And then Ellington out of nowhere.
And then Ellington hits 4 threes, yep. So, you know, really behind the arc again, the Miami hits 10 threes. They actually hit 7, I think, in the first half. They only make 8 a game. So that 3-point shot, I thought, kept them in that game right for the better part of 3 quarters. But in the end, it just was not enough. The Hornets really struggled again last night from behind the arc, Richie.
And last little bit about, just players on the opposing team. Like Justice Winslow as well, he was a non-factor. We've had this discussion before whether or not Frank was the right pick or Justice Winslow would have been the pick. And I was all for Winslow, but after watching him play over these past 2 years, I'm not sure he's not the better pick. I mean, not
he is awful offensively.
Yeah, I mean, I watched a game. God, I cannot remember who they were playing, but I remember it was on TNT, and it was his best game of the season. Like he was getting up and down the floor, driving to the basket, you know, making tough transition shots. And he's a rebounder, but he just keeps shooting, and he's got to improve that shot. So like no one respects him. It's almost like a Kaminsky situation in which Okay, you can take this shot, but it's probably not going in.
I was thinking about this last night watching the game. I mean, he literally – this couldn't be a worse fit for him in terms of a team that they're a half-court offense. They don't have really any spacing. They can't shoot. I mean, everything's clogged for the Heat offensively, which is obviously not a good fit for a guy that can't shoot, which Winslow is. He needs to be – see, I think you plug him in to maybe like a Hornets in this style that they play, which is – you know, motion offense, the ball moves a lot. There's more driving lanes. There's more freedom for certain guys to put the ball on the floor, make a play.
He would be like an MKG in terms of, like, you know, cutting to the basket. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how he, you know, I don't know that he fits next to MKG.
No, not at all.
But I think this is the worst possible scenario for him in Miami as they're currently constructed. I hate it for him because I really liked Winslow in that draft. And I still like him as a player. He just, to your point, he does. He needs to play up and down. He needs freedom of space and freedom of motion and freedom to go make a play because he can't be a playmaker. But yeah, it's not happening in Miami this season. All right, let's stay with Nick Batum for a second because I saw a few tweets last night, and actually I'm not going to mention the guy, but somebody tweeted at me how bad Nick Batum is and, oh, I hate watching this guy play. And he did struggle offensively last night. Just one of those games where it doesn't seem like he's engaged and not looking for a shot. But when you can have a bad game, which I think for the better part of this game, he wasn't good offensively, but finished with a line of 16 points, 13 rebounds, and 8 assists. And that's a bad game. Do you know how many guys?
I'll take that, yeah.
There are literally less than 5 guys in the entire league that can put up statistical numbers from night to night like Nick Batum can. So let me just explain something to everyone. I'm tired. I'm done. I'm done listening to you complain about Nick Batum. And so please don't bring it my way, because you just don't understand how to watch basketball if you're going to complain about what Nick Batum doesn't bring to the Hornets. If you're only hoping for him to score baskets and make threes and make highlight plays offensively, shooting the basketball, then you're not watching the game the right way. He is a prototypical player, basketball player, of how the game becomes easy for the other 4 guys on the court because Batum has the basketball and he's looking to distribute. He sees everything on the basketball floor, and he makes the game so much easier for the other guys playing with him. So we got to start watching the game through those lenses when we're watching Batum. Here's the reality, Richie. He's not a great offensive player. Okay, he's not a great three-point shooter, and really he's not a good finisher at the rim. His length bails him out a lot of times,
right.
And when he's active in pushing the ball, you know, and getting out in transition, make a play, he can be good, but he's not this super skilled offensive player. But what he is a second distributor next to Kemba, and a guy that can run the offense, so you can get guys like Kemba off the ball, coming off screens, and people have to start watching the game that way when watching Batum. He's never,
right.
probably never going to be a great offensive player, but there's very few guys in the league with his physical tools that see the floor like he does.
And I think what gets these fans is that he signed this big contract and they're expecting his production to increase. Like that's not him. I mean, he's trying to get others involved. Like you said, he's a second ball handler. That's kind of why they're playing him in all the first quarter, because when Sessions comes in, he's not much of a distributor. That's kind of where Batum comes in. So, yeah, just looking at him and how he plays the game, you got to look at it in a different way. I mean, he will stuff the stat sheet before you blink your eyes. He'll be near a triple-double by halftime. So he just gets others involved. He makes the offense run a little bit better. And if you look at his stats, last year, points-wise, is very similar to this year. And that's probably because he's kind of had a rise in his production recently. In December, he's averaging 16 points, 9 rebounds, and 7 assists. So, yes, he's not going to be the player that you give the ball to at the end of the game. He's not going to be scoring 20 points a game like Kemba is. But he's still one of our best players.
Absolutely. And let me ask you a question. As a Hornets fan, if I ask you, do you think that the Hornets, you watch them offensively, haven't been awesome this year, but are they one of the more creative offenses in the league, just in terms of, it doesn't even appear like there's they're not running plays out there. They're not pounding the ball down the floor and running a set every time down. But considering that, would you say this is one of the more fun, creative offenses, pick and roll heavy, yes, that there is in the league? Would you say the answer to that is yes?
I mean, I can't say because I haven't really watched a lot of other teams play basketball this year. I mean, I've watched on and off, but I mean, I think, like you said, it's very pick and roll heavy. So if it's when it gets going, I think it's very interesting to watch, like the third quarter against the Magic. Very unselfish. I think that's what I love to see about this team is a lot of distributors on this team. They want to get others involved. And when Batum is on the court, you kind of see that in action. Just a lot of movement off ball, off of screens. So I don't know if creative is the right word, but it's definitely fun to watch.
Fun to watch. And Batum is the reason for that. You know, Kemba is the offensive horse. And he's the firepower. Batum is that second guy that really makes the wheel turn. So let's try to consider that when watching him, because he's not an all-star offensive player. All right, so let's kind of revisit the Jeremy Lamb conversation. We were talking about it a little bit ago and kind of what he's brought to the table since the Bellinelli injury. Have you seen an increase? Obviously, an increase is in his numbers and in his role since Bellinelli was out, Richie. But what have you seen from Lamb recently? Positive, negative? Has he been pretty much the same guy?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's been pretty much the same guy, just getting a little bit more increased minutes since Bellinelli went out against Chicago, or including that game. Bellinelli's been averaging 22 minutes a game, which is up from 16 minutes a game. But we've kind of seen this, you know, up and down play throughout Lamb's career and through this year. But recently, he's been averaging these last four or five games with Bellinelli out, 12 points a game, 5 rebounds a game, and 45% shooting. And he's never going to be a three-point shooter. I think he excels in transition. I think he excels with the ball in his hands. I think sometimes he stops the movement of the ball at times. But he's getting better at that in terms of not letting the ball stick in his hands too much. But he's one of the few players on our team that can create off the dribble and kind of score off the dribble in mid-range. He's very deceptively, like, lanky. Like, you know, is he 6'6 or something like that? But I think he has a wingspan of, like, 7 feet. So when he gets to the basket, he can score over people because of his length. Yeah, so, I mean, recently it's just been more of a increased role, I think. But I think we've seen this throughout the season. But I think he does need to see the court a little bit more than he actually does. And I think that's what Clifford is trying to do, tinker with his lineup and have him be the first one off the bench.
Sure. And I agree with all those things you just said about him. His mid-range game, that's a great point. His mid-range game has been, I think, the biggest leap for him offensively this year, because he really hasn't been as good maybe offensively as I thought. He's shooting right around 25% from behind the arc this year, which is really a lot lower than I realized it was. But being more decisive in the pick and roll, which you can put him in that situation with that second unit, being more decisive, coming off that screen harder, going towards the rim, and using that mid-range game when the defender sags down or sits below the pick, is really been an encouraging aspect of his game. But you're right. I would still like to see him just be more decisive as a player. The ball gets to him, and he loves to stand there with 2 seconds. For two about 2 seconds and survey what his decision's going to be. It should be about a split second. You either shoot it, you pass it, or you put it on the floor and make a play. And that's just a part of it's part of Lamb's game that it has always been a little bit of a struggle. But he's done a nice job floating this bench while Bellinelli has been out. And I think he's going to continue to improve. I mean, you see a guy, you just watch his body language. When he makes a good play, he's going to let you know about it. He's going to let the opposition know about it. So it seems like a player who's hungry for success and hungry to get better, which was one of the knocks on him and why he was buried on Clifford's in Clifford's doghouse last season. But I really think he's improved, and defensively is where I think he's gotten a lot better. I watch him on that end pretty intently, and he is not missing rotations very much anymore. He's tagging Rollman. He's getting on the backside. He's getting on the backside for those rebounds, boxing out. I mean, he's engaged on that end of the floor. And to me, it's pretty obvious that that was a benchmark he was going to have to meet if he wanted consistent minutes under Steve Clifford. And although I think you see the offense suffer sometimes with Lamb because of the effort he has to give on the other end, that's just a part of his maturation as a player. And so I know some of the numbers aren't ecstatic and right where you'd like them offensively, but I think he's improving as an overall player. And here's a guy I think that I really like his game. I hope he stays a Hornet for a long time, but I think he's that sneaky trade chip maybe to watch too.
Oh, yeah.
On a friendly deal for the Hornets, who's an improving player and still a young player at only not even 25 years old yet. So,
Yeah, he's one of my favorite players on the team, but I would not be sad or upset if we did trade him, because he is probably one of the more enticing players that we can kind of get in a trade to kind of bring something back.
Agreed there. All right, good. So we'll hope to have Marco back as early as tomorrow night. But we'll just have to wait and see. Probably more likely like it'll be Monday night. So the Hornets now stand at 19-14. They are now tied after Boston's loss in Cleveland last night. They're tied for third in the Eastern Conference, and Toronto lost last night too. So you gain a little bit of ground on them. Richie, what do you see right now as the path? I mean, it's obviously still early, but what is the path for the Hornets to ultimately catch Boston, jump them for that three seed in the East? And is there a chance that anyone can catch Toronto?
I think it's going to be difficult. I mean, we are, what, four and a half, 3.5 games back or something from Toronto. We're tied with Boston. I know it's early, but I just don't see us catching Toronto. I guess that's just more of a pessimistic side in me. But I do think that, us in Boston will be battling it out to the end. And I think that Boston's a very good team. They have some firepower, a little bit more than we do. They live and die by the three. And they do have a couple of players that I don't think get, enough credit. Two of my favorite players on their team are Avery Bradley and Jae Crowder. I'm sorry, Avery Bradley, just a good shooter from outside, from deep. He is the best perimeter defender on that team. And I think he leads the team in rebounds as well. So he's got to be one of the best, rebounding guards in the league. And then Jae Crowder as well. He just lights it up from downtown, and he's always finding open spots and spaces on the floor to get Celtics open three. So this team that we're going to be battling with down to the wire, I mean, they post similar numbers, but they go about it in a different way. Their offense is a little bit better than ours. They're unselfish, and they can hit the three ball to a certain extent. They do like to shoot a lot of them, unlike us. So it's going to be difficult. I think they have a little bit more firepower, but I think we play a little bit more sound team basketball on both ends of the court. And we're going to have to win games like we did with Miami, where we're, you know, battling it out, grind it out, not a lot of turnovers, limiting second chance points for us to be successful, where Boston has players like Horford and Bradley and Isaiah Thomas that can go off at any night.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of similarities with Boston. I think the philosophies are very similar with Steve Clifford and Brad Stevens. I think Stevens is better in the game scenarios. I don't know if there's a guy really better in the league than that guy drawing up a game-winning play or a situational play. But I think the philosophies are very similar defensively and offensively. Boston is – they're deeper offensively. They're tooled a lot better, I would say, than the Hornets are. But, you know, right now it's kind of interesting when you look at where both of these teams stand in efficiency. Boston's a top 10 team offensively, eighth right now. Where would you guess, without looking, where would you guess they are defensively right now?
17.
They are, yeah, that's exactly right. They're 17. So did you just guess that or did you know?
No,
that?
I had looked it up prior. I didn't know off the top of my head, but I knew they're kind of like average defensively.
Yeah, so these teams kind of, to be honest with you, Boston is exactly defensively where the Hornets are offensively, which is about 17, about where the Hornets stand right now. And then, you know, the flip side is true. You know, the Hornets are, let's see, defensively now.
Fifth?
Well, the Hornets are fifth now. They've climbed back to fifth. So they're actually a little better defensively than Boston is in the standings offensively. But I think the philosophies are similar. I would not want to see Boston in the playoffs if I was any team, especially Charlotte. But, you know, I think it's unlikely the Hornets will be able to catch the Celtics in the standings when it's all said and done. I just think Boston, you know, Horford was out for a good chunk of the beginning of the season. Now he's in the lineup consistently. They're healthy. They seem to be kind of gelling together now that Horford has kind of been in the lineup for an extended period of time. I think they're learning how to play together. If Boston avoids an injury, I mean, I think they're a serious team to challenge Cleveland in the Eastern Conference Finals. I don't know that Toronto's I don't know you just pencil them in to the Eastern Conference Final against a healthy Boston team. And then I think the Hornets, they just need another piece. They're not, as they're currently constructed, there's just not enough there, I don't think, to get them past a Boston or a Toronto to the Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
You know, but again, Richie, this all comes down to injuries in the end. And it's something we don't talk about enough every single year. But, you know, here's where we're kind of sneaking up on the All-Star game. You know, you look at these top four teams in the East, they're all really healthy. I mean, J.R. Smith is out, you know, for what, 6 to 8 weeks for Cleveland. But, you know, Toronto, Boston, Charlotte, for the most part, knock on wood here. Of course, I've just jinxed it, but everybody's been healthy, you know, and that's the way you want to see it. Now, if that continues, again, what we've said is, I don't know if Charlotte's got enough, so the trade deadline becomes interesting. But yeah, I like Boston. The original question, I like them. I think they're a team that could challenge Cleveland as they did last night. They have a three late in that game, Richie, to take the lead with about 8 seconds left. Crowder had a good look. He misses it. I think that got Cleveland's attention, or at least it should have, because they were at full strength last night. So I don't know the Hornets have enough right now. Obviously subject to change, though.
Yeah, currently, I mean, I just think we just have less room for error than some of these teams. And I think currently constructed, we're probably, at the best, probably a 3 or 4 seed, you know, at the best. We just have less room for error with teams that have much more firepower than we do. But, you know, we play sound ball. We don't limit a lot of second chance points, and we do the little things, and that's kind of what keeps us in this race.
Exactly. Yep. And it kind of goes down that conversation that we had in the last episode, which is, you know, what do the Hornets need to take that step up to be in a situation where they can more realistically compete with Toronto or Boston in the playoffs? What are they willing to give up, or what move are they willing to make? So we won't have that conversation again, but, you know, as the Hornets continue to, you know, to churn out these wins and keep pace in the standings, and then the closer we get to that trade deadline, it's going to get interesting, because that's a really, really tough question to answer. If you're Rich Cho, I think he stays patient. I think we both agree on that, but, you know, at the same time, if you're right there and you have a chance, You don't know if that chance will be there again next year. Do you make the deal that they put you in better space, or what you think a better spot to make a run, and do you give up those pieces? So we will continue to monitor that. Anything else on kind of the standings combo right now, Richie? Well, let's do this because I think we had fun last week on this conversation. What has happened in this back part of the Eastern Conference that we were discussing last week that maybe is interesting? Let's look at that real quick.
Pacers have fallen.
Pacers have fallen. So they've lost four straight. Yeah, man. Ooh, they have fallen. So they're 15 and 18 now. And
Washington's now in the eighth spot.
So Washington is – they're in the ninth.
Oh, ninth spot. Excuse me.
Yeah, ninth spot. So the Pacers are a game and a half outside of the eighth spot, which is Milwaukee. And then, yeah, Washington's a half game back. Orlando, they're now two games out. Detroit's two games out. So this thing's starting to
take shape. I just think there's a clear divide between the top four teams, yeah. Cleveland, Toronto, Boston, and Charlotte, than the teams below. Like it's such a you know, up in the air with those teams.
I would agree there. You know, I mean, now you've got a two game difference between the fourth team in the East, which is Charlotte, and the fifth team, which is New York. Did you see that New York Boston game on Christmas Day?
No, I did not.
That was an entertaining game. New York had a chance to win that game. They're a good team. I mean, I like them. Anytime you've got a Carmelo Anthony and a Porzingis on your team, you're gonna win games. That's the one team I could see keeping pace with, like a Charlotte and a Boston.
Yeah, I mean, I could definitely see it. But I don't think it's gonna happen though. I think that the divide might be a little bit bigger come February and March.
Yeah. So all right, here's what I want to do. Philadelphia cross off, Brooklyn cross off, Miami cross off, Orlando, Detroit, Indiana, Washington. Any cross offs? Are you saying right now?
Cross off Orlando.
Cross off Orlando? Okay, I like that. Anything else or every other team in the East? Are we still saying hopes are still very much alive for the playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that Detroit, even though they're struggling, and like you mentioned last podcast, since Jackson's come back, they're like 4-9. They're kind of on the downturn here. They're 3-7 in the last 10 games. They still have a chance, I think, to compete for the eighth spot. I mean, it's going to be difficult. It might be a little bit improbable, but I wouldn't rule them out. But I am ruling out Orlando.
I would agree with you. And kind of staying on Orlando for a second, here's the interesting thing. I think Hennigan, the GM there, I said it earlier in the show, I think he is fighting for his job. Now, I don't know if that's win now or you're gone, or that's fix this mess that you've created with this roster now, or you're gone. Does that make sense, the difference between the two?
Say that again.
So I don't know, like in Orlando, I think Hennigan, I think his job is on the line, like as we talk. Now, I don't know if that means his job is on the line because the pressure is for him to win right now. Like he needs to make the playoffs this season. Or I don't know if his job is on the line because it's just fix this mess that you've made on this roster, get rid of some of these bigs and make us just make more sense from a roster standpoint. So the difference between those two, yeah. You think it's the latter. See, I think he might need to win now. I think all these moves were made because Orlando wants to win right now. And I think they made a lot of these moves too. They wanted to put these defensively minded guys around Frank Vogel, who was a great defensive coach in Indiana. It just hasn't worked. I think he has to win now. So either one of these scenarios, right, either reason for him to keep his job here, what he's got to do, it demands what, Richie? I think it demands a big move at the trade deadline. So they're going to be a really interesting team to watch. And the other thing is there are some pieces on this team, a lot of them, that can help other teams. So watch Orlando at the trade deadline. You think he just needs to fix the mess he's created on the roster.
It is both.
I think he probably needs to win. It is both, but I think I think the two are mutually exclusive.
Well, to get better, he's going to have to clean up the mess, right?
Well, yes, but you get what I'm saying. Like to get, yes, right. But what I'm saying is like, does the front office say like you have to make the playoffs this year, regardless of anything else that you do? Or you're gone.
Gotcha.
Or you can keep your job if you don't make the playoffs, but you gotta make this roster make more sense holistically. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying. So one is for the future, one is for the now.
Exactly. Yeah. So my roundabout way of explaining that, you just said it in about five words, which makes a lot more sense. But so that's what I'm saying. So Orlando is it's interesting to watch. They're gonna make a trade at the deadline, and it's it's either going to mean Hennigan gets another shot at this thing and can run it back, or he's out of there. All right, so we don't know a lot in the East. We know a little bit more, but let's keep watching. But I agree with you. I'm crossing Orlando off now. So that, let's see, that takes our number down to 11 teams in the East that we are still considering alive for the playoffs, crossing the Magic off. And we'll revisit that every show. All right, let's do a quick run-through go ahead and preview the play next week for the Hornets. They'll host Cleveland tomorrow night in what looks like a huge game for Charlotte in a possible statement game. They're at Chicago Monday. Wednesday, they host the Thunder. Thursday, they're at Detroit. Saturday, at San Antonio. So a tough stretch coming here.
I think so. I think realistically, and I mean, I once again, I may be the pessimistic view. I think realistically, 2-2 would be good. I think that Chicago Monday should be a win. And I think we should get a win either Wednesday versus OKC or Thursday at Detroit. I've once again, Saturday against Spurs. I don't see that as being a win, or at least not favored win. Interesting thing about this week is obviously three games away, but the Thursday game against Detroit is a back-to-back for us, but it's not a back-to-back for Detroit. They play Tuesday, have Wednesday off, and they'll be sitting at home waiting for us to come and arrive on Thursday. So that's kind of why I'm tempering my expectations for this week. If you look at it, you could maybe expect maybe three wins, but I think two wins is probably where it's going to end up in come Saturday after San Antonio.
What is it about us getting Detroit on a back-to-back and them coming on? That just seems, yeah, that's weird. I mean, you know, you would think that, like, if you're going to play a conference foe numerous times a year, that the schedule makers would try to find a way for, you know, one team not to have to play more back-to-backs against that same team. You know, right. You'd be at least split those, but that's not the case for Detroit. So we get them once again on a back-to-back. And right now, what it doesn't seem like a head-to-head that'll matter in the playoff standings, but, you know, it is still early, so that seems a little unfair. All right, so would you say 2-3 counting the Cleveland game tomorrow night?
Yeah. 2-3.
Okay, so you're saying the Hornets are not going to win tomorrow night?
Basically.
Okay. All right. I have a little bit more hope. I think that Charlotte finally gets up for one of these games against a superior opponent. They just haven't had a whole lot of staple wins again this season. It's kind of been their thing over the Clifford era. They get enough wins against the teams they're supposed to, but they don't get enough of those big staple wins, especially at home. So here's another opportunity on New Year's Eve tomorrow night in what should be a really, really good atmosphere. I mean, I think this is one of those things where – you know, the hive is jumping tomorrow. Tomorrow night, the Spectrum Center is packed. You know, it's a 7 o'clock tip. People go out right after the game. I think it's going to be a really cool atmosphere and a great opportunity for the Hornets. I'll say 3-2 over this stretch. You know, I think just at Chicago, at Detroit, at San Antonio, I think the Hornets probably drop two of those three. And then I think they get the ones at home. And then one of those games on the road.
Gotcha.
Most likely, probably Detroit. Well, no, that's a back-to-back. Probably at Chicago would be the most likely. So I'll say 3-2. So look out for a tough stretch coming up for the Hornets next week. All right, Richie, New Year's resolution for the Hornets. What's one or two things you hope for the Hornets to change in 2017?
Okay, so when it comes to New Year's resolutions, I don't ever make any because I will never follow through with them. But
you're smart.
Yeah,
you're smart.
Exactly. So typically, New Year's resolutions are something that might test your will a little bit, but they're still somewhat realistic. So when I thought about this, I kind of gave a lot of thought to this, and I was kind of struggling with an answer for this, a New Year's resolutions for the Hornets or a player on this team. And the one person I'm going to focus on is Frank Kaminsky. Now, I don't necessarily think this will happen in 2017, but it's more of my hope, and I could see it happening. It's more of a realistic option here. So my New Year's resolution for the Hornets / Frank Kaminsky is for him to become a little bit more stronger, I guess, in attacking, finishing around the rim, and on the defensive end. I think that he needs a little bit more Cody Zeller in him, get a little bit more physical, and it would help his game out a lot. I know that he's very good at driving to the rim, making a couple moves here and there and getting to the basket. But I just remember a potential and one last night against Miami. It was a great pass. I want to say it's from Batum. And it looked like he had a step on the guy. It looked like he had height on the guy. But he gets fouled in the process of a layup. And I wish he would have gone up for it a little bit stronger and dunk it. So I'm not going to call Frank Kaminsky soft by any means. But my resolution for him is just to become stronger in all aspects of his game.
Yeah, that is one of mine as well, Richie. You know, I'm to the point where I'm ready to punt on Kaminsky because he's so frustrating for me to watch. But and I'm not the only one. But he's one of my New Year resolutions. I mean, I hope that he improves as a player on this team. Physicality, you pointed out, it's the weakest part of his game. I mean, there are a lot of weak parts right now. But I honestly can't believe he's still getting the minutes that he's getting. You know, playing given the defensive effort or lack thereof that he's given right now to this team. I mean, watching him guard an opposing player on the post is really, really tough. I mean, he just almost moves out of the way.
Right. I don't even know what position he can defend better. Like, I just, some days I'm like, okay, he can guard the center better. Some days he can guard the power forward better. But I really don't think there's a clear-cut answer there.
Well, there's not, and that's the biggest problem with Kaminsky moving forward as a player in this league. I mean, I think we all see the offensive ability, you know, offensive talent, which he hasn't exercised much this season, but it's there. We know it's there. We've seen it before. But defensively, I mean, I don't know who he guards. He's a seven-footer, so I don't know how you hide him. You know, he's not some guard you can just put on the corner sniper. He has to guard somebody, either the power forward or the center. And right now, to your point, he's proven that he can't guard either. So, you know, I think the Hornets continue to give him minutes because he is that guy you can go small with, playing center. He is a lethal, you know, pick and pop guy, or at least a pick and pop guy that teams need to respect. Right. But yeah, it's getting ugly with Kaminsky. Last night, he goes 1 of 11. In Orlando the other night when everybody was good. He's 3 of 11. I mean, he's just really, really struggling. So, you know, I think his confidence is shot right now. And we actually got a good Twitter question that we'll cover here in a minute about him. So, I don't know what Clifford does. I mean, you need him on the floor because you're thin in the front court, you know, especially at the power forward position. But Kaminsky's struggling at astronomical rates right now. Yeah, the only other New Year's resolution I would have is, selfishly, I would like to see the Hornets do something to give themselves a better chance come postseason to make a serious run, because, you know, I think it's something that fans are hungry for. I think it's something that fans deserve. You know, I think this has been a great rebuild for the Charlotte franchise, you know, from a roster standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, you know, going to the changing back to the Hornets. I think they've built up a really, really solid fan base there in Charlotte. And then I think that those fans deserve, you know, a serious run, and it might not work, obviously, but how can Rich Cho do that without mortgaging too much? Is a very interesting question, and one that we'll continue a conversation that we'll continue to have, but that would be my selfish, New Year's resolution change I'd like to see made. Is I'd like to see a roster move, and I'd like to see, Rich Cho give this team a chance to make a run to the Eastern Conference Finals. Let's dive into some Twitter questions here. We have a few. This one is from Marion at Radford 333. I'm worried about Sessions. He looks a step slower, and he's not a good shooter, not a good combination. So not really a question here, but a statement, and we'll talk about the statement. Richie, I'll let you kind of start with that one, because Sessions has been better.
Yeah, he has been better over, we would say, you know, the month of December. He's getting better progressively. He started off real slow, and I understand what this person is trying to say. If he's not a good shooter and he's losing his step on his driving ability, what does he actually offer to this team? And, you know, he's not a player that gets others involved. He only averages 3 assists a game. So, yes, there is something to be worried about with Sessions, but the good thing is he's improving. And Batum, a lot of time is in there with him, so he can take over the ball handling duties, the initiator of the offense. We just want Sessions just to go out there and make as, you know, the least amount of mistakes as possible, give effort on defense, and then drive with authority, but not get too out of control when he gets there. So, yes, I understand the concern, but unless we make a trade, he's our best option, I think, at backup point guard.
Yeah, he's been a lot better here recently. I mean, in the month of December, he's shooting almost, well, he's shooting 36.5% from behind the arc. Doesn't take a lot of them, about 1.5 a game in about 16 minutes, but that is a massive improvement to literally not being able to throw the ball in the ocean at the beginning of the season. So, you know, shooting 42% from the floor in the month of December. And here's the thing that Sessions does that I think is a little underrated. People know about it with his game, but they don't talk about it enough. You know, he gets to the foul line a ton. I mean, in 16 minutes, he gets there about 2.5 times per game. And, you know, the Hornets as a team get to the foul line a lot. So I think he kind of fits the DNA of what they want to do offensively in that way. And so if he can just be competent from an efficiency standpoint from shooting the ball from the field, you know, I think that getting to the free throw line and attacking the paint is something that he really, really does well and fits the style of this Hornets offense. To your point, Richie, you wish he was a little bit more of a distributor and would look to share the ball a little bit more than he does. But his assist to turnover ratio is still, you know, somewhat respectable. I mean, for the season, it's about 3-1. So for a backup point guard.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe I don't give him enough credit for that. So, I mean, he probably does do a little bit more in that area than I probably give him credit for.
Yeah, but he's been better. I mean, I think that's kind of what we're talking about. He has been better, and he makes that conversation that Rich Joe has to have about making a move at the deadline probably a little tougher. And I even think, you know, these lineups where Kemba and Sessions have played together, and we've seen them more in the past three games without Bellinelli, they've showed some success.
Right.
So he's been better. We'll keep an eye on Sessions and see if he continues to improve, if he levels off, if he digresses. But it's a positive sign right now. Okay, let's move on to the next question. This one is from our good friend Mark, who writes for the blog. He is at Hornet Sport Spot on Twitter. Is it time to minimize Frank's role for a bit before he loses all confidence? Take some pressure off. Is the question. I think it's a good question, and I think we pretty much discussed it earlier. We probably should have waited knowing this question was coming, but I'll let you take that one, Richie.
I know how he would answer this question.
Yeah.
He would want Spencer Hawes to get a little bit more play time. Now, I mean, right. I don't think
– Homer. He lives out in Washington State, for those who don't know it. Spencer Hawes played at Washington, so come on.
It makes sense why he likes
– just being a homer, right? We're messing with you, Mark.
No, I mean, I don't mind Hawes, but I just don't see it happening. I think Clifford's pretty set in his rotations. You see that Hawes doesn't really get in unless it's that blowout game like we had in Orlando. So do I think that it needs to happen? I don't. I think he just needs to play through this. You know, my hopes before the season was for him to shoot better from the three-point line, but now my hopes for this season is just for him to shoot the same clip that he did last year. So he does offer some things out on the court. He's not a great three-point shooter, but at least players close out on him. Mm-hmm. I don't think that would be the case with Hawes. And Hawes, when he attacks that closeout, is sometimes indecisive. Kaminsky, to an extent, is as well, but he can get his way to the rim and score at the basket. And I think we also distribute the ball a little bit better when Kaminsky's out there. So he just needs to work through it. I know that his confidence is probably a little bit shot, but you really wouldn't know that because he is shooting the ball a good amount from three in terms of attempts.
I mean, I think he has to keep shooting. I mean, as a scorer, you just got to keep letting it go. But yeah, I don't know the answer to this, Mark. It's a good question. I think it's a conversation that the coaches are having. And, you know, here's what I'll say to this. I've been tossing around an idea in my mind for a while, and I don't know if it's ever been mentioned out on the Twitter sphere or not, but I don't know if this is the worst idea I've ever had or the best, but I will I'll mention it. So how about Frank Kaminsky for Willie Cauley-Stein or something in, you know, there might be other parts coming and going, but I think, you know, a situation like Sacramento where they would let, and we'll wait to see what happens with Boogie. But, you know, I just think Frank needs a situation, offensive situation, where he's more kind of the center point, a younger team where he can have the ball in his hands more, being more of a creator. I just don't know. I'm not sure that he quite knows how to fit into the Hornets system. And with the second unit, they'll try to run plays for him and get him the ball, you know, around on the right block. But Yeah, I just don't know that he really knows what his identity is. And when he's not shooting the ball well in an offensive system like this, his ISO heavy mentality, it just doesn't fit here. And I think Willie Cauley-Stein has experienced a lot of the same problems in Sacramento, just in terms of he's a rim runner. He's an energy guy. He's a rim protector. I mean, he does not fit. You know, he doesn't need the ball in his hands.
No.
But he's just standing around offensively in Sacramento and not setting ball screens because everything goes through Boogie. So he's not a good fit out there. You know, I think that swap could maybe – I think it might be good for both
players. But where would he fit in our rotation? Because he's a center. Yeah. He doesn't create much space. Would he replace Hibbert?
Maybe. Maybe. You know, Richie, what I would say to that is Cauley-Stein defensively can definitely guard fours. He can switch on to threes. He could, quite frankly, he can switch on to twos. So defensively, all of a sudden, you're a lot better with that second unit. I think he can play four because he has those defensive tools. I know offensively he doesn't bring anything, and it's a big downgrade offensively. But when you look at what Frank is bringing to the table right now offensively, which is basically zero, I think it just means a larger role offensively for some other players that maybe aren't getting that that opportunity right now. And maybe Sacramento will send us another piece back, right? Maybe if we send Frank and name your other pieces off of our roster.
We can get Malachi back.
or maybe, you know, who else they're looking to get rid of and not Rudy Gay. We're not going to go down that foxhole. But Ben McLemore. I mean, they want him out of there. And does Ben McLemore, you know, provide an offensive punch enough off the bench? Maybe in a Bellinelli, McLemore, Jeremy Lamb, wing tandem with Cauley-Stein out there and name your point guard. I mean, I think those are things to ponder. I think Sacramento has pieces that can help us. And I think, vice versa is true for us towards Sacramento. But I think that swap just might make a little sense for both players. At the end of this idea that I have, here's what I'll tell you. I think that Rich Cho is calling around or at least trying to gather information throughout the league of who believes in Kaminsky's ability still. You know, everyone sees the struggles, but who thinks that their system fixes all the problems? Because he is a unicorn, and he's not a basketball unicorn in this league, but he is that versatile – talent-wise, unicorn in the fact that he's 7 feet, he can dribble, he can shoot, he can pass. There's just not a lot of guys like that. So who out there believes they can fix the problems? Frank's a guy who could be moved. Yeah. And I think Sacramento's makes some sense. So I didn't really answer the question, but it gave me an opportunity to tell you my idea.
Well, I mean, I think we could all say we're probably not opposed to trading Frank, but currently as it stands, I don't know if I want to speak for you, but I think he just needs to play through this. Just play through it, even though his confidence may be shot. So to answer the question, don't give him less of a role, but we're not opposed to trading him whatsoever.
Right, right. Okay. We have one more Twitter question. We'll try to do this one quick because we got to go. Okay. I like this one a lot. This is a really good question. So Kemba Walker is the unanimous, all-star candidate for the Hornets. Is he the MVP of the team, Richie? And I think that there's the one other player who might be contend for the MVP of the team. How would you answer that? I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's a difficult question. Very interesting. I would still say that Kemba is our MVP of the team. He's having a great year this year. He's the one player that we can turn to late in games and take the ball. And I understand where the question's coming from. Is it Batum? Batum is the one that gets others involved, makes it easier for other players. He's having, great play as of late. Is he the MVP, but Kemba is the all-star? I understand the question, but I still think that Kemba is our MVP. He's having a great year shooting, and it's very difficult to defend him. And when we need a bucket, that's who I want with the ball in his hands.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about. I mean, Kemba's obviously he's the best player on this team. That doesn't always –
equate to MVP, yeah.
Right. I guess it just depends on how you define MVP. But I just think, Batum being that three-tool guy, just all the things that he can do, all the things that he opens up, how much easier the game gets for all the other players on the court when they play with him. I think that's where the conversation gets interesting. I think it's still Kemba, But it's really, really close, and it's something that we should talk about more, just so we can focus on what Batum really brings to the table, which we also talked about earlier. But yeah, that question was from my good buddy Tom Allison, who I don't even know if he has Twitter, but he texted me that question earlier this morning.
Good question.
And I thought it was a good one. So, all right, Richie, anything else we need to plug, talk about, anything like that before we wrap this thing up?
No, I think that we are good. We've covered it all. And as we're wrapping up this show, I just want to give a couple shout outs, or I guess one shout out to the person that does our intro and outro. He has a SoundCloud page. His name is DJ Quads. That's Quads. So if you just search SoundCloud, you can find all of his work. He does instrumental and beat work. And I kind of stumbled upon his SoundCloud and thought it was good stuff. So that's kind of why I chose him for our intro and outro. So once again, you guys can check us out on SoundCloud as well. Just search QCH Podcast and iTunes, do the same.
Okay, awesome. All right, so thanks again to all of our listeners. Please make sure that you let us know what you think about the show by hitting us up on Twitter. Speaking of, make sure you're following Queen City Hoops on Twitter at QCH Blog. Follow Richie at Richie Randall. And follow me, if you're not already, at QCH Spencer. Richie, I think that's a wrap. Okay, until next time, folks, which will be sometime after the new year, that will do it. And so on that note, everyone have a happy new year. Go Hornets.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.